This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I feel like a locomotive sipping, drinking Arizona. Mixtape just around the corner. Did a lot in California. Can't wait to drop this, don't you? Yeah, they gon' have fun with that. Smash like
hello, and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. Mark Daly and Mark Hamilton here to discuss all the latest news and goings on in Formula One. Hammy, how's it going? You're looking very, very intense on the other side of the studio here, my friend. What's up?
Things personally are well, but you know, sometimes when we glance around globally, there's a lot of really negative things happening. So I think right off the top, I think our hearts obviously go out to everybody in Atlantic Canada that was impacted by a massive storm a few days ago. Our hearts go out to everybody in Florida as we record.
Yep,
I think that storm is descending on that state, and everything that's continuing to happen in Ukraine. And of course, I'm as particularly close to the situation because my wife is from Iran, and has been a big proponent and a big supporter of the protests that are happening in that country, demanding better human rights and better equality for women. A lot going on around the world. So if I look a little intense off the top, I think I got a lot weighing on my mind right now. But all of that said, we come into the Scuderia F1 podcast studios every Wednesday or every Thursday night, and we focus on something positive so that all of our listeners can kind of tune in and have fun and detach from the craziness that is everything that's going on in the world around us.
Yeah, 100%. It's not to say that we kind of disregard all the things that are happening, both good and bad around the world, but this is just a nice little distraction for an hour or so every week, just to,
exactly,
just like you say, focus on something different and just decompress, although Formula One can sometimes drive us a bit bonkers as well. But just talking about Hurricane Ian, and this is not something that's necessarily new. I've seen this before, but NOAA was at the National Oceanographic and something or other down in the States. What they fly these P3 Orions, I think they are, into like these massive hurricanes, and then they launch all these weather probes and things like that. And I've seen it before. What they do is they put the aircraft on autopilot, and as they get buffeted around and all the high winds and things like that, the plane more or less kind of takes care of itself. And I saw some video footage of this one plane, this NOAA plane going into basically the eye of Hurricane Ian, and the crew members on it is just like, we've never seen anything like this before. I mean, there's stuff flying all in around inside the aircraft. I'm like, yeah, no, please. If that phone call, like anybody ever wants to make that phone call, say, hey, you want to come along? That's the hardest of hardest passes. that's a full stop. No, that's a non-starter. But massive respect for people that do that, because that looks to be like a little bit of a scary job. So anyways, before we get into it, first of all, going to give a shout out to JT the Human, the very, very talented artist who provided and our opening music here. You can find his everything he's got on iTunes, Apple Music, or whatever they call it now. I always forget, but love our opener and love that. And also big shout out to Micah, DJ Vinyl Richie on Twitter, who helped hook us up with JT. So there's never get tired of that. And then also, you wanted to give a shout out to The Race Weekend and Magnus, our good friend, who creates the most beautiful of Formula One publications. And I'm still blown away that that's done locally here in Vancouver. Like, I shouldn't be surprised. I mean, there's many creative and fantastic people in Vancouver, but I'm just so proud that they would call Magnus a friend of the show, and just the work that those guys do, because it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I don't think I really need to continue trying to sell our audience on this publication. I feel like I've been doing that now for about a year, because I think it was probably about a year ago that you and I began our journey, our relationship and our friendship with with Magnus. But obviously, we've spoke incredibly highly of this publication for the better part of the last year. And if it's something you're interested in, or if you're looking for a gift, a holiday gift, because the holidays are fast approaching, if you're looking for a really cool gift for that Formula One fan in your life, now would be the perfect time to subscribe. And if you do and use the Scuderia Pod promo code, you will save 10% at checkout. And like I said, we don't typically come on the show and promote Formula One products and content unless it's something we believe in. And this is a really great one. And if you do subscribe now, you have plenty of time to get that first issue. So it's ready to be gifted to that special somebody come the holiday season.
Yeah, theraceweekend.com sells itself. We don't have to say anything more because we'd probably do a terrible job and probably not help Magnus the way that we intend to. Anyways, before we get into the meat of the show, let's just quickly go down the Drivers and Constructors Championship. It's late here. It's already almost 10 p.m. Pacific here. So it's way too late to caffeinate at this time of the evening. So if I stumble a little bit, I'll forgive myself at least. Anyways, we'll just run down the Drivers and Constructors Championships in advance of the Singapore Grand Prix, which is coming up this weekend. Really excited for that. First one since 2019. My goodness, how time flies. The Formula One Drivers' Championship, Max Verstappen leading the way at 335 points, ahead of Charles Leclerc from Ferrari with 219. Sergio Perez, the second Red Bull driver, 210 points. George Russell from Mercedes, 203. And Carlos Sainz from Ferrari, 187 points. On the constructors' side, if Max and Sergio are 1 and 3 in the drivers, it's no surprise that Red Bull is the top of the constructors, and they have a very impressive 545 points. Ferrari second with 406, Mercedes with a very respectable 371, Alpine is fourth in the constructors with 125, and McLaren Mercedes, the last team in the constructors to currently be racking up three digits point totals in the Constructors' Championships, and they have 107. So you're studiously examining your screen, and there's only a slight look of fear, which kind of makes me wonder that you're trying to load the F1 Fantasy League standings, and it's it's good to go. And
my friend, we're not going to do that update today. I feel like I've probably done the fantasy update 3 or 4 times now since we've had a Grand Prix. So we all know who's in the top 10. And if you're not, you still have time to make some movement. Just make sure you lock in your lineup for this coming weekend. But I'm not going to read the F1 fantasy standings until we get through the Singapore Grand Prix.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because, I mean, last couple of weekends, we didn't have a race. And we were sitting here this time last week. Oh, boy, you know, it really seems like it's been a long time since there was a race, to which, you know, many of our community members and fellow F1 fans kindly reminded us, yo, guys, this is the time of year that the now canceled Russian Grand Prix was supposed to be going on. So no wonder it seemed longer than usual, is because there was, they were canceled. So
Daly, it's remarkable
how soon
that
the two
of us could sit here and not think twice about the fact that, is it that odd? There's a 3-week break in September. Okay, I just accepted it rather than processing that. No, of course, you're right. This is when the Russian Grand Prix would have been. And of course, it was absolutely and appropriately canceled probably 6 months ago now. But yeah, dawned on me that that's why we were sitting through this long 3-week break. So shame on both of us, and props to everybody. And it was probably 100 of you that reached out shortly after that podcast dropped last Friday to remind us of exactly why we had a 3-week break.
In my defense, I don't even remember what I had for lunch this afternoon. So, you know, trying to go back like a week or 6 months, it's just not going to a good place that makes me look good. Not that I look good in the best of times, but there you go. Hey, so we're going to delve into the mailbag now. And you've got an email from Marshall that you want to share, who he doesn't want to contradict us, but we talked about beforehand, and he raised some really, really good points that, based on a topic we were discussing either last week or the week before, just about the FIA, who they are, what they do. And it was really well thought out, very well written. So we thought we'd share it with everyone. And so now time to put your reading glasses on, my friend. Oh, you're holding the finger up at me.
So
that means either wait or you're good. Okay.
I'm good. The reason I was grimacing a couple of minutes ago is as I get increasingly older, the fonts on my computer screen get progressively larger. So I was trying to figure out how to make this email appear a little bit bigger so I could do it the justice it deserves. So Marshall, obviously a longtime listener and a big supporter of our show, is regularly in our Spaces chats. We talked to him tonight, and he does a really great job sometimes of counterbalancing some of my, I would say, poorly founded opinions. But I want to read this email to you because he makes some absolutely terrific points, and it's a really great perspective that helps to balance out some of my more hot takes that I would say that I've had over the last few weeks and months about the FIA being little more than a quote-unquote contractor. So I'll read it now. And I quote, "Hey, Mark and Mark, as always, I enjoy the show greatly, and I just want to commend you guys for the great job that you do taking a nuanced and impartial view of the goings-on in F1 week to week. You both do an excellent job of cutting through the nonsense and telling it like it is, and in engaging fans in a resolutely positive and inclusive way that invites fans new and old like me to take part in the conversation. You guys have the best F1 podcast out there, and it isn't even close. I wanted to try and give a little bit of a counter perspective, if I could, of the FIA versus F1 issues that I think could be a little bit more nuanced." And he writes, "I think it is a bit unfair to see the FIA as merely a contractor to F1, as you said on the last podcast. As the world governing body for all of motorsports, they are responsible for administering and managing all levels of motorsport from the top down to the grassroots. F1 sits on a pinnacle that is built on the foundations of the weekend racers, the aspiring professionals, and the thousands of volunteers that give up their time in local regions to make all kinds of motorsports happen, of which, full disclosure, I am one. Without the FIA, its component national ASNs, and its army of volunteers to run an event, F1 simply cannot operate in the way it does and certainly would not be near as profitable. F1 is not bearing the brunt of the cost for FIA-led innovations such as safer barriers, Tech Pro, the Halo, the Hans device, which have made the sport safer at all levels, but it has benefited from them greatly. The FIA and F1 are distinct, but codependent organizations that exist as a check on each other in balancing the commercial demands with the sporting and safety aspects of a sport that is much larger than just F1. But in the necessary push and pull, this can sometimes give way to conflict as their goals may not and should not always be aligned. The FIA may rubber stamp the schedule, but not all things. They're more than just a contractor. They're equal partners. I think this separation is sometimes not appreciated or understood by fans and the media when things go wrong. There's a tendency to, for whatever reason, blame the governing body exclusively for decisions that may have been made in tandem with or even at the request of Formula One for commercial reasons, and that F1 is just fine with that confusion because it keeps the heat off of them directly. For example, Andreas Seidel let it slip that the FIA and F1 tried to change the safety car rules to avoid the reoccurrence of races like AD, but the teams blocked it. So the FIA getting flack for the way Monza ended under safety car, according to the rules as they exist, is unfair since they did try and change it. Likewise, the controversy over super license points denying Herta his earned F1 shot is due to a system that was developed at the request of and in consultation with Formula One to strengthen the position of the F2, F3 ladder series that F1 itself owns. While F1 CEO Stefano Domenicali did an interview resolutely defending the super license rules, citing all the same points as the FIA, it barely registers as a blip, and it is again the FIA taking all of the blame for quote unquote their system. I get the feeling that the FIA is pushing back a little bit on this tendency for F1 to push or at least passively allow blame to fall in their direction, especially when the FIA is an organization of thousands of volunteers who have nothing to do with the decisions at the highest levels of F1 who are having their work indirectly described. Credited. And he almost wraps up here, so we're just about done. While you can say some of this comes with the territory of being the referee, I think that is also somewhat fair. Your comparison to NBA refs was off because NBA refs aren't being blamed by anyone for the rules themselves or commercial decisions of the commissioner. And if they were, I think that the NBA would step into their defense and say, no, this was our decision. I have pride in the FIA patch I wear in the uniform when volunteering because I know the hours that thousands of people have put in to be part of the sport, from the local weekend auto slalom or time stage rally to the very pinnacle of motorsports. F1 is the top of the pyramid, but still part of, and without being a part of the FIA, they lose that status. Thanks again for all you do with the podcast. And keep up the awesome work, Marshall. P.S. Loving the F1 book club. Can't wait for more. Marshall, thank you so much for that fantastic email.
Yeah, that was awesome. Yeah, I love it when people take the time to write in like that. And, you know, I don't mind anybody taking a contrary view to us because, I mean, we have our own points of view and our own takes, right? Where I don't like is, oh, you guys suck because reasons and then kind of like that. But so, yeah, you know, massive props to Marshall for that great email. And there's a lot to unpack in what he brings up, and which I think are all really, really good points because, you know, if you really want to sort of split, you know, the things even finer, you've got the FIA, you got Formula One, then you got the commercial rights holder in Liberty Media. So there's a lot of different entities at play. And I think that, you know, he was right in bringing up the whole thing about the safety car that we saw after Monza. And that is true that, you know, that the teams basically stepped in and said, no, we don't want to change the safety car rules when the FIA themselves were pushing for it. And it's a little bit ironic. I mean, especially after all the, you know, outrage and all the fury after Abu Dhabi last year, that it just seemed like it was the one obvious thing that needs to be, you know, dealt with ASAP. And obviously Monza didn't have quite the same outcome and consequences as Abu Dhabi did in 21. It just kind of left everybody with a bit of a sour taste in their mouth. And it is funny, though, the way that people do react and point fingers, and they like to sometimes really put the blame on governing bodies or officials and things like that. You know, it is interesting that it's not necessarily unique to any one sport, but I think maybe in motorsport, it's a little bit more obvious because it just seems, well, there's only one person you can, or one body you can blame, right? And that's the FIA. And, you know, it's funny that he should also bring up that whole super license points, because it's just so ironic that the fact that, you know, this whole super license thing has sort of come up the last little while, and how it's so overlooked, like he says, that Formula 2 and Formula 3 are all properties owned by Formula 1, how they have this almost this monopoly on how, you know, they sort of funnel drivers into the sport. And it's like almost it's very deliberate in the fact that, yeah, okay, you can be a one or a two time or a three time IndyCar champion or not, or maybe you're a young hot prospect in IndyCar or wherever, but you're not coming through our officially sanctioned funnel, so we're just going to make it that extra difficult for you to accumulate those points. So I don't know, you need to jump in here now, because I feel like, you know, there's so many points that Marshall touched on that I'm starting to ramble now. So
no, rambling at all. I think I totally agree with your point. And a couple of the things that resonated with me when I was reading this was, one, obviously just reinforcing that very, very tight relationship between Formula One and the feeder series, mm-hmm. Formula Two and Formula Three, that obviously Formula One is financially incented to drive their development prospects through their own ladder system. And that's just reinforced through the super license program, which as Marshall states, was itself co-developed at the request of F1 and its teams. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the comments that he made here was that in the weeks kind of surrounding the whole Colton Herta pandemonium, which was, should there be an exception? Again, we were all looking at how super license points were awarded, and this was just broadly a part of the greater F1 conversation for probably a solid month there, was the fact that the FIA was taking all of the heat, that ultimately that the super license program was developed by the FIA and it was implemented by the FIA, and the FIA were to blame. And obviously, I wasn't particularly satisfied with the comments of the FIA president as it related to that program, but he makes a really great point. Marshall makes a really great point that CEO Stefano Domenicali also spoke firmly in favor of the current FIA super license program. And that didn't register anywhere in terms of the news cycle. It didn't register anywhere. Salem's message resonated everywhere and was picked up by every F1 publication. But Stefano Domenicali also commented and indicated that there was no appetite to make a change and that the current rule set was going to be enforced. But that didn't get picked up anywhere. And I think it was because it wasn't convenient to the greater narrative that now has the FIA effectively a punching bag. And to be fair, the FIA has done, and members of the FIA have said some things that have made it easier or an easier target. But at the same time, I feel like there are moments where the media and myself included, because I saw that Stefano Domenicali comment supporting the super license construct in its current formation. And I don't recall talking about that on the air, but I sure as heck certainly refer to Ben Salem, Mohammed Ben Salem's comments about the FIA super license program. So I think I'm guilty of it. I think collectively we're probably guilty of it. And I think part of it too is we just don't have as great an appreciation for what the FIA does globally across all disciplines of motorsport as maybe we should.
Because 100%.
We sit here in North America and we are surrounded by NASCAR and we're surrounded by Indy. And the FIA has obviously very little to do with those two preeminent motorsport disciplines in North America. But if we leave North America, well, almost every motorsport series that you're going to come across is interwoven with the FIA in some way. It's just, it's kind of an anomaly in North America where they're not as closely integrated. But yeah, I think this is a great email. And like I said, I love when people challenge us in a respectful way, because I feel like I'm better educated. And I think our audience is probably better educated now having read this email.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I do have a couple of points I just want to pick up on the
that
email. So this is going to take a couple of minutes. So let's jump quickly into a break. We'll come back, discuss Marshall's email a little bit further, and then we'll dive into the news for the week. So guys, don't go away. We'll be back on the flip side in just a moment. So time to go top up your drinks, put on those nice comfy jammies or slippers or what, however you enjoy the show, go and do that. Noah, we'll be back in just a moment. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to me talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
All right, welcome back. Mark and Mark here, breaking down, we're about to break down all the latest news from Formula One, but we're just talking about a listener email from Marshall in the previous segment. And there's a couple of things that just sort of jumped to mind as you were discussing some of the points that Marshall raised. Number one, I find it very interesting how Ben Sulayem's comments really echoed, really kind of struck a chord. And I mean, it's not unusual for the FIA president to say something that really gets picked up, but for some reason that the comments that he made, in the last week or two have really seemed to have struck a nerve or really sort of reverberated more than maybe other comments in recent times, that is. I'm not particularly sure why that is. I don't really know a lot about Ben Sulayem, but I thought it was a bit of an interesting phenomena. The other thing too, just going back to the super license point, points. And I think this is kind of interesting because we're talking about a little bit about this sort of like Formula One monopoly on the feeder series in F2 and F3. I mean, if you go and look at it, it's obvious all the branding is very similar from the logos and it's got a very F1 feel to it. So, I mean, that's the way they want to funnel the drivers into the sport. F1 basically had the final say on how the super license points are accumulated, how drivers can get into Formula One. But what I find really, really interesting is the whole Colton Herta saga, right? So here's this, hot, young, talented, just coincidentally American driver who's being linked with Formula One, is just a little bit on the lean side of not having enough points to get a super license. And, you know, he's been linked with AlphaTauri, which is obviously part of the Red Bull family. Red Bull, of course, have two teams. They're in two different locations. So you have the big team and what we call the junior team in AlphaTauri. But what I find interesting is Red Bull are touted to have this really phenomenal, driver development academy. And over the past several years, they've struggled to get guys into their cars that have the requisite number of super license points. Now, so they're looking to potentially bring a guy like Colton into Formula One. He doesn't quite have the amount of points that he needs, but yet I know he said that he doesn't want the rules to be bent for him to be a special exception. And, you can understand why. But I just, am I the only one that kind of sees the irony in one of the big players who owns two teams in Formula One, who has this, pumps, a vast fortune into their driver academy, can't develop enough drivers with super license points, and now looking to go beyond the Formula One development funnel and finds a driver that they like that would be, a good fit for their one of their teams, but they can't get in because they're kind of like hamstrung by the rules that they had a hand in developing. So I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I do see a bit of irony there. So anyways, I'm just going to put it out there. But I think time to move on. Marshall, again, thank you for the great email. Thank you for the work that you do as a track marshal. And, it's people like him that make motor racing what it is. And it's people that get involved at the grassroots that make racing what it is. It doesn't matter if it's Formula One or down at your local racetrack on a weekend. It's the grassroots and the people that are on boots on the ground that make it all happen. Okay. So it's sort of I don't know what to make of this one, man. This next story that Formula One is extended the sprint calendar, sprint races next year from 3 to 6 races. We've talked about it. I mean, when these were premiered last year in 2021, and even before that, we were kind of excited about it. I think our enthusiasm really cooled once we saw them in action last year, and to a certain extent this year. Now I'm kind of the point is like, oh man, like I think I would have been good with 3 for next year. I did really want to see it extended to 6 because it hasn't really lived up to what we hoped it would be. And I don't know. I don't really feel the urge or the obligation to go and sit down and watch the sprint race. It just hasn't done it for me yet, Mark. So I don't know what you're going to say, but I have the feeling that you're probably having a similar reaction to this news as I am.
Very, very much. And I just going back to 2021. Is this the second full championship? Yeah, we've been doing this. Oh my goodness, I just realized we're about to hit our second. We're just weeks away from our 2-year anniversary doing the show together. But I specifically recall in 2021, I was especially excited about this concept of a sprint. And I didn't like the way that qualifying was configured during the race weekend. I didn't relish the way that points were being distributed. And obviously the teams, the FIA Formula One, they listed some of the feedback and they reconfigured the sprints for 2022. Although of course it was controversial because we were expecting 6 and the FIA got a lot of blowback because there was a perception or it was reported that they were demanding more money. And because of that, we only ended up with 3 instead of 6 this year. I don't know, man. Like we're now 2 years into this experience. And for me, it's just not clicking. And I don't know if that's the way I should put it. And I saw a story earlier this week from racefans.com and their headline was something to the effect of F1 to hold 30 races in 2023 as 6 sprint events are confirmed or something to that effect. I was just like, we're going into a championship next year that has 24 races on the calendar, the maximum allowable by the Concord Agreement. And with all due respect, I know that F1 isn't particularly demanding of its fans. It's not like the NBA, which has 82 games, or baseball that has 162. It's pretty low maintenance in terms of what it demands of its viewers. But 24 races, and on average now, a race every 2 weeks over a 12-month calendar, is asking a lot from people that are conditioned to a 16, 17, 18 race calendar. If you look at the last 20 or 30 years of the sport, 24 races is a lot already. And for me, I want to like the sprints, and I like the way it's configured this year more than I like what we saw in 2021. But I'm not particularly excited about this. If it was somehow meaningfully impactful to the championship, maybe. But we're going to see 24 races next year. And to me, that's enough. And I spoke for so long about the fact that this is a lot less about creating competitive characteristics or embedding incremental competitive characteristics within a championship, and more just about offering up. And I get it. Like, ultimately, Liberty's responsibility is to deliver value to its shareholders by increasing the value of the product and getting more eyeballs on the product. And the sprint race weekends, in theory, should be able to extract more money out of race organizers, and it should be able to get more money out of the TV networks because you have an extra event over the course of a 3-day weekend. But for me, it just doesn't click yet. And when we've been going into the sprint weekends this year, it's kind of been a chore, to be totally honest, man. It's kind of been a chore that I kind of like the 3-day race weekend that we have. We got a couple of practice sessions. Saturday, we got a practice session. We have qualifying and we have the race. That's great. The sprint just hasn't clicked with me yet. Not in a meaningful way. And I'm not saying you need to scrap it, but I'm not particularly excited about going into a 24 race calendar with 6 sprints. Like, and just speaking as an adult, I've got a full-time job, I've got a family. I don't have, like, I have far less time than you do because you've got a much bigger family than me.
I feel you.
But it just, it doesn't click, and I'm not super excited, and it feels like it might be a bit of a chore.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, too. If you read some of the comments from Formula One president and CEO Stefano Domenicali and the FIA president Mohamed Ben Sulayem, I feel like there's a little bit of a disconnect between what, you know, their point of view is and, you know, what's going out here in like the fanosphere, if that's a word. If it isn't, I guess we just coined another term here on the show. It was Domenicali had said, quote, "I am pleased that we confirmed 6 sprints will be part of the championship for 2023 onwards, building on the success of the new format introduced for the first time in 2021. The sprint provides action across 3 days with the drivers all fighting for something right from the start on Friday through the main event on Sunday, adding more drama and excitement to the weekend. The feedback from the fans, teams, promoters, and partners has been very positive, and the format is adding new dimension to Formula One, and we all want to ensure its success in the future," end quote. Whereas Ben Sulayem had to say, quote, "The confirmation that the 6 race weekends featuring sprint will take place from the 2023 FIA Formula One World Championship season onwards, and is another example of the continued growth and prosperity at the highest level of motorsport," end quote. Yeah, I mean, I don't disregard, you know, I don't disagree with either of those quotes. You know, I think they're both accurate from their point of view, but like you say, it just hasn't really... It's just not quite doing it for me yet. And maybe this year is a bit of a bad example to look at, because the championship isn't the gap between the competitors at the top. I mean, between Max and Charles, it's not tight like it was between Lewis and Max last year, right? I mean, there's daylight between Max Verstappen and Charles Leclerc. So these points that they're accumulating in the sprint races aren't really doing a lot to really influence the championship one way or another. I mean, if Charles scores the max 8 points and Max doesn't score any at the next sprint race this year, like, who cares? It makes no real difference in the overall championship itself. So, you know, like I say, or like you said, pardon me, I don't want to like throw it away. I just don't think that the ultimate, like the perfect scenario has really been found yet. You know, I think it's interesting. I think it adds a certain novelty to the weekend, but boy, like you said, it really introduces a level of commitment. Because I mean, if you just take you have 24 races, so that's 24 Grand Prix that you have to watch, plus the qualifying sessions, that's 48.
That's a great point.
And you know, for the diehards that go in there and watch all the free practice sessions, I mean, you know, by the time it's all said and done, you could be committing up to somewhere close to 100 sessions over the course of an entire season. I mean, that's a lot of time, you know. I mean, especially for those of us that just do this for fun, you know, we're not getting paid, we're not paid media. I mean, just even from a fan point of view, that's a big time commitment that not very many people have. Anyhow, it is what it is. Okay, the next story is that Mercedes and Petronas are going to extend their partnership into new sustainable fuels in this new era of Formula One. So they are going to be working with Mercedes, Petronas that is, to 2026 and beyond. They've been partners with Mercedes since 2010, so well over a dozen years. And that is just really, you know, a real, I think, testament to show the strength and the quality of the partnership that they have. And you need, I think, good partners like that. I mean, especially where we're going into this new era, new power units, sustainable hybrid exotic fuels and things like that. I think it's going to be a very, very exciting new era of Formula One. I mean, these V6 turbo hybrid engines that we've had, 1.5 liter turbo hybrid engines that we've had since 2014 are technological marvels in themselves. So it's going to be really exciting to see where they take this technology, both you know, in the form of the power unit itself and what goes into powering this power unit. I think it's a very, very exciting new era that we're going to embark on very, very shortly.
I preface everything I'm about to say by acknowledging and recognizing that Petronas is itself a massive oil and gas company, but they have been closely intertwined with Mercedes really since they entered the grid. Remember back in 2008, it was Honda, 2009, yep, it was Braun, and then Mercedes bought them to be their works team for 2010. And Petronas has been their title sponsor for this entire period. So it would be really strange to see a different brand or to see Petronas removed from the car. I'm just reading this as well because I thought this might be interesting, but Petronas is I'm going to read this quoting from Wikipedia here. Petronas is a Malaysian oil and gas company established in 1974 and wholly owned by the government of Malaysia. The corporation is vested with all oil and gas resources in Malaysia and entrusted with the responsibility of developing and adding value to these resources. In the 2017 Forbes Global 2000, Petronas Gas was ranked at 1,881st. Petronas also ranked 48th globally in the 2020 Bentley Infrastructure 500. I have no idea what any of that means. But to take it away, Petronas at the end of the day is a major global oil and gas producer that is wholly owned by the government of Malaysia. And they've been tightly knit with, obviously, Mercedes for this entire time. And I think sometimes I think there's this apprehension or anxiety about major global energy producers because of sometimes their lack of commitment to exploring renewables and exploring a green future. But I think if Petronas is going to renew its partnership with Mercedes, and Mercedes is a Formula One team, and Formula One has a commitment to different types of renewable energy and kind of limiting its carbon impact, like, I think it's a good thing because it forces this major oil and gas company, and I don't know enough about them to understand what their commitment is to renewables and green energy and things like that, but I think it's a good thing that ultimately this company is partnering with Mercedes, and Mercedes as part of F1 is being forced down this path of becoming more environmentally conscious by reconfiguring the way that the cars operate in this global climate change crisis.
Well, you know what? I can prove for a fact now that Toto Wolff listens to this show, Hammy, because he's heard your comments. Not only has he heard your comments, he's doubling down on those because, you know, he's heard what you said, how the tightly knit Petronas and Mercedes AMG Formula One are. And this is what Toto had to say, quote, "Today we are doing something a little bit unusual, announcing a partnership that will begin in 4 years' time. This sends an important message. Our team and Patronus are no longer just partners. We are family, and we will be one team for many more years to come. From 2026, advanced sustainable fuel will be at the heart of F1 performance, and this gives us a fantastic opportunity to demonstrate our expertise in this domain through both the power unit and the Patronus fluid technology solutions. We are excited to be racing into the future alongside Patronus with the ambition to set the standard once again in our on-track performance and by pioneering the transition of a global sports team to a net zero future, end quote. So there you go. They're not just partners, bro. They're a family. But, you know, joking aside, it, yeah, I mean, to have a, you know, a big oil and gas producer like that committed to, you know, developing sustainable fuels for the Formula One program, I think is important. And, you know, we sometimes say we don't see enough trickle down technology from Formula One, make it into the vehicle that I drive and you car or drive and everybody else that's listening to this. So hopefully these new hybrid sustainable fuels are, you know, pun intended, a trickle down technology that we'll see hit the roads in the not too distant future. Okay, moving along and sticking with a sort of a related topic, Ross Brawn, who has been in Formula One for many, many, many years. Of course, you just mentioned Brawn GP. That was his team after he bought out Honda at the end of 2008, which was basically the sowed the seeds of what has become the juggernaut of Mercedes. I was wondering
where you were going with that.
It's clever, right? Or, you know, is slightly stumbling, however I'm doing it. Anyways, Brawn is now 67, and he said he's planning to take a significant step back from Formula One after the end of this season. So he began working for Motorsport way back in 1976 for March Engineering, pardon me, engineering. That's another big word for tired mouths and eyes at this time of night. Joined Williams a couple of years later. He worked with Benetton, Ferrari, of course, his own team, and Mercedes for a couple of years. And he's been around the sport for a long, long time. He's been, what was his title? The managing director of motorsport, something like that. Very grand. To Formula One. Yeah, so he had a brief retirement from about 2014 to 2016, and then was tempted, lured, drawn back in about 5 years ago. And he's been one of the people, the figures really involved in this new era of Formula One. And he's a guy that's really had really influenced the sport in many, many different ways and many different roles. And he wants to cut back, and he'll be still making his expertise available, but he won't be responsible for everyday tasks and jobs and things like that. So I dare say he's earned it. And like I say, I mean, he's had a massive influence in this sport over many, many decades. A very, very impressive career.
Absolutely. One of my very favorite people in the entire world of Formula One. You look at his track record. He was with Benetton from 91 to 96. And I think people forget that he was the technical director there when they won a couple of championships with Michael Schumacher in 94, 95. And then he transitioned to Ferrari shortly after Michael Schumacher did. And of course, from 97 to 2006, they won, I think, another five championships together. And he took a one-year sabbatical. Correct. And then there was this huge rumor at the time that he was actually being courted to Red Bull and that he was going to be part of a package that helped entice Fernando Alonso to go to Red Bull. But ultimately, he pivoted and he went to Honda as the team principal. And of course, he was only there for a year. He had to turn around a big organization. And by the time he felt like he had a quote-unquote race-winning car, Honda backed out of the sport, and it was ultimately Ross Brawn that helped broker that partnership between his now personal team, Brawn GP, and Mercedes to create that race winning, that championship Brawn GP car in 2009, which of course became the Mercedes Works team. And of course, he's been involved in so many different threads and so many different levels of Formula One in the past three or four decades that I think it would be hard to imagine the sport without him. So if he wants to take a little bit of time and he wants to step away from the sport and he wants to focus on his family and his personal well-being, that's fantastic, because I often forget that he is 67 years old, but he's an incredibly interesting guy. And I hope every day that eventually Netflix does a 10-part series on Braun GP. I want to know, and I want that series to start from the moment that he gets that call from Honda to drive down from the factory in Milton Keynes to Slough, where the Honda F1 team is told, well, he is effectively told that Honda's pulling out. And from that moment on, he's got to desperately race to find an owner to buy that team to keep it in F1, ultimately is unsuccessful in doing so, effectively buys the team itself, and then helps drive them towards a world championship in 2009. To me, that would be a fascinating 10-part series or a movie. I don't know if it's ever going to happen, but some of my favorite moments in F1 intersect with parts of his career.
Yeah, absolutely. As Rocky in the live chat on YouTube says, the kids would call him the OG, and I think he's absolutely correct in that take. And, you know, funny you should make the Netflix comment. I've been watching The Last Dance again, so it'd be amazing if they could do something like that. I mean, they probably don't have the footage, but, you know, if they did, could they get Rodman involved? I feel like, you know, Rodman would add, you know, I'm just rambling. I'm taking the show off the rails here, so let's take another break, and when we come back, since the show's already gotten a little silly, why don't we dive into silly season and pick up on some of the rumors that we were talking about last week. And we'll do that in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, welcome back to the show, and time to talk about silly season or the 2023 driver market. Still a couple of teams still with seats up to up for grabs next year. One of them is Alpine, the other is Haas, and the other one is Williams. So not really any one of your number one front runners, but Alpine could be a bit of a dark horse if they ever get their act together. So Esteban Ocon is confirmed at Alpine for 2023. So the odds on favorite to go there still Pierre Gasly, the outsiders, which I think we talked about last week or the week before, Jack Doohan, Antonio Giovinazzi, Mick Schumacher, Danny Ricciardo, and Nick DeVries, who we saw a couple of weeks ago filling in for Alex Albon at Williams. And then you have going over to AlphaTauri. So Nick DeVries is the favorite to go there if Gasly leaves. Kind of sounds like he's probably going to Red Bull, who are the ones that ultimately kind of determine the whole thing, said that you know, they're basically open to him leaving, but you know, somebody's gonna have to give them a golden handshake in the form of a buyout to pay out his contract or whatever it is. So Gasly leaves, he could end up at AlphaTauri. Then you have Haas, you have Antonio Giovinazzi, the favorite to go there, who's been in and out of Formula One a couple of different times over the past couple of years. And the outsiders there, Nico Hülkenberg, Mick Schumacher, and Danny Ricciardo. I mean, Mick Schumacher obviously has a history with Haas. He's been there for the past two seasons. Ricciardo, man, you know, I struggle with that one. You know, I can see why he's been thrown into the outsiders discussion. I mean, if I'm Danny Ricciardo, I mean, I don't know if I want to take that step and, you know, take a drive with Haas for next year. And then finally, you have Williams, Nick DeVries, again, the favorite to go there. I mean, he's the favorite for two of these three seats. Some of the outsiders, again, Logan Sargeant, Mick Schumacher, and Antonio Giovinazzi. Giovinazzi, man, I kind of struggle with this one. I mean, yeah, he's kind of a decent driver, but I feel like he's already had a couple of shots at Formula One. And, you know, I mean, he's a decent driver, but is he, you know, that good that people are really banging on his door to bring him back for another full-time race seat? I think, I know that these are further down, mid to back of the pack kind of teams, but still, you know, I just find, you know, his name being thrown out there as, you know, the favorite for a couple of these empty seats, I find a bit, I wouldn't say a stretch, but I find it just you know, one of those kind of things that kind of scratch my head at.
Agreed. I do have to call you out, though. You missed a very important story before we jumped into the absolute chaos and pandemonium.
Oh,
and you alluded to it by alluding to the fact that Williams have an open seat, and they do officially have an open seat because as of earlier this week, Canadian Williams driver Nicholas Latifi announced that he will not be returning to Williams for 2023. Says Jost Capito, and I quote, "I would like to say an enormous thank you to Nicholas for his 3 years of hard work with Williams. He is a great team player who has a great attitude towards his colleagues and work and is well-liked and respected throughout our business. Our time together is now coming to an end, but I know he will put full effort into maximize what we can do together for the remainder of the season. We wish him all the very best of luck for his future, both in and out of the cockpit. We wish him all the very best of luck for the future, both in and out of the cockpit." And then Latifi says, "My initial F1 debut was postponed due to the pandemic, but we eventually got going in Austria. And although we have not achieved the results together we hoped we would, it's still been a fantastic journey. Getting those first points in Hungary last year was a moment I'll never forget. And I will move on to the next chapter of my career with special memories of my time with this dedicated team. I know none of us will stop putting in every effort until the end of the season." So some very nice, very kind words from Jost Capito, of course, the CEO and team principal of the Williams Formula One team, and some nice, kind, reflective comments from Nicholas Latifi, who will now exit Formula One, leaving just one sole Canadian driver on the grid.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we ever really questioned Nicky's determination or professionalism, both in or out of the car. But I mean, man, you look at Nicky's stats for this year. His best finish came at the British Grand Prix, and that was a 12th. He's got three DNFs. But I mean, out of the last four races, three P18s, and at Monza a couple of weeks ago, he finished in 15th. And I mean, his that's compared to Nick DeVries, who'd never raced in that car before. He came home and bagged a couple of points for that P9 at Monza. So, you know, like I say, don't question his heart or his professionalism, but sadly just not getting it done with the results on the track. And, you know, it's just not really a good look when you get outperformed by the reserve driver who's, you know, doesn't have, you know, a fraction of the time behind the steering wheel of that car as you do. So sad to see him go, but it certainly sets up for an interesting discussion as to who might replace
him. I'm very curious, and I don't know that many of our listeners will be particularly interested, but I'm very curious to see where he goes next in his career. I think oftentimes when an F1 driver exits the sport, they may exit Formula One, but they certainly don't leave the sport of motor racing. They end up in Formula E, or they end up in DTM or supercars or any of the countless other championships across the world. I'll be very curious to see where Nicky goes, because I think for a lot of these younger drivers, they scrape and they claw and they fight desperately for funding to get through F3 and F2 and then potentially into F1. And, you know, obviously Nicky worked equally as hard as any of those drivers, but he was also blessed with some funding that helped to accelerate his journey into Formula One. I'm very curious to see if he continues on his journey in motorsports and pursues a different discipline and maybe goes to Le Mans or maybe goes to Super Formula or any of these other championships. I'll be very curious, or whether he sees this as an opportunity to get into the broadcast booth, because he's very polite, very charismatic, very articulate. He could be really great in media, or perhaps he goes into business. But I'll simply repeat what Jost Capito said, because I very much agree with this. But we wish him we wish him all the very best of luck for his future, both in and out of the cockpit. And I absolutely, certainly reiterate that sentiment.
Yeah, 100%. So that now begs the question, who replaces him? And I think we had this conversation last week. And, you know, like I say, I think it's kind of funny that that Giovinazzi gets thrown out there a couple of times.
Infuriates me.
Is this just, you know, people speculating, just kind of throwing out familiar names? Maybe he lands one of these seats. Maybe not. I mean, Pierre Gasly going to Alpine, you know, just it makes so much sense and it ticks so many boxes. And I think we talked about it at length either last week or the week before. But I can see that deal happening. And it sounds like what really needs to happen is that they need to go in and basically buy up Gasly's contract at AlphaTauri, you know, right to Red Bull a nice big fat check, and then they can go and do that. And I think, you know, and we've talked about this not for just weeks but months and probably even longer than that Gasly, I think, needs to be one of these guys that needs to get out of that Red Bull system. Ricardo obviously felt he was one of those guys, and arguably it hasn't worked out for him, because I mean, he's very much now the odd man looking out in Formula One. I mean, if you go from Red Bull to Renault to McLaren, and then you, all of a sudden you're kind of being linked to having potentially like an outsider first seat at Haas, I mean, boy, that says something about how much your stock has fallen. Although, you know, Ricardo's name has come up in some different circles, which we'll talk about in a little bit here. But I would be, as much as I struggle to see, you know, kind of reconcile the whole Giovinazzi guy in a car for next year, the one name that I have no problem kind of reconciling to see that he's linked to a potential drive is Nyck de Vries. Because I mean, we've seen what he's done in Formula E. We've seen what he's done elsewhere. He had a very impressive outing at Monza a couple of weeks ago. Okay, sure, that's only one Formula One race. But still, I mean, he did, you know, to get into your points or get into the points in a car like that in your very first outing is impressive. It turned a lot of heads. It got a lot of people talking, and rightly so. Your thoughts now?
No, I very much agree. I think obviously Nyck de Vries is going to find his way into Formula One next season. And you know what? Even as recently as a month ago, I don't think there was any assurances that he was ever going to get a ride in Formula One. This is obviously a guy who won an F2 championship, couldn't get an F1 seat, went to Formula E. We heard Toto talk about the fact that, look, I can't find him a place to race because we simply don't have an opening, and none of the teams that we have a technical partnership or technical relationship with have an opening for him. He got that amazing opportunity with Williams at Monza, and of course, Monza is a track that is basically designed for the current Williams car as much as a track can be designed for a current Williams car. And he went out there and he executed, and he executed in a way that his teammate on that race weekend absolutely couldn't. So in his performance that weekend, he basically assured himself of a contract for 2023, but also simultaneously assured Nicholas Latifi of the fact that he wasn't going to be returning to Formula One simply because the delta between the two of them was so significant. So I think de Vries is going to be in, but I think Williams, in their hesitation, actually maybe hesitation isn't the correct word, because I think at some point during the season, they were probably fairly confident that Oscar Piastri was going to be riding with them or driving with them for 2023, and that deal fell apart. But mm-hmm. I think in their hesitation to announce a different driver for 2023 other than Nicholas Latifi, I think they may have lost out on Nyck de Vries, because I think 2 months ago, had they gone to Nick and said, hey, look, we'll offer you X amount of dollars for a one-year deal or a two-year deal, I think he's probably going to take that deal simply because there isn't another one on the table. But I think their hesitation has probably cost them Nyck de Vries, because I think Nick is going to probably end up now with AlphaTauri, which is a improvement or an improved opportunity by a magnitude of 10 versus the current Williams chassis and that current Williams team. And of course, they're going to get better the longer that Jos Capito is there. But ultimately, I think they had a chance, an opportunity to get Nick, and they kind of missed the boat on that one. So I don't know where they're going mm-hmm. to go. But I agree. I get a little bit upset when we see so many of these drivers being recycled through Formula One. I like Nico Hülkenberg. I don't think he needs to have a full-time F1 ride. I like Antonio Giovinazzi. I don't think he needs to have a full-time F1 ride. There's just so much exceptional talent out there that maybe isn't in the Formula 2, Formula 3, or Formula E channel, but there's so much global talent that I don't know why we need to keep going back and recycling through these people. Like, what is the harm of giving a ride to an Indy champion, somebody that's accumulated enough FIA super license points that I would say, and I would argue that the Indy Championship is hugely more complex and difficult than Formula 2 or Formula E. And I think the media obligations are harder. And I think the tracks are more difficult. And I think they're harder cars to drive. Like, I get frustrated when we see people continually recycled through Formula 1 when there's so much talent available globally and there's just this hesitation. So, yeah, who Williams is going to end up with now, I'm not sure, but I don't think it's going to be Nyck de Vries. But having said all of that, I'm also not super confident and I'm not super convinced that Nyck de Vries is going to be a slam dunk superstar in Formula One as well. And we could be sitting here 2 years from now talking about whether he's going to get re-upped with AlphaTauri or whether his time in Formula One is over as well. Because I'm not convinced. He is 27.
That's a fair point.
He is 27.
Yeah, that's funny. I can have this perception firmly in, implanted in my mind that Nyck de Vries is much, much younger than that. But maybe I just haven't been paying attention the last couple of years. But one team that's actually been smart enough to extricate themselves from this whole silly season discussion is Alfa Romeo. And they've decided to re-up Zhou Guanyu, the young Chinese driver, again for next season. Team principal Frederic Vasseur said that Joe's form this year has been what he called a surprise. And I wouldn't say that this was a no-brainer. I mean, of course, you always have to take a look around to see who are the best drivers available. But I think that Zhou Guanyu has had a very, very good rookie season in a so-so team. I mean, they're sort of a middle-of-the-pack kind of team, but he's got a very, very good teammate in Valtteri Bottas, which I'm sure has been a great learning experience for a young driver like that. So I think that this one kind of really sorted itself out. I mean, I think that if they looked around, it's just like, hey, well, we've got a young guy in our car, but he's almost got a season of Formula One under his belt. He's been doing pretty good. So let's give him a shot to build on this season and see where he goes from there.
Can I just say that he is quickly becoming one of my favorite drivers in Formula One? And sometimes I put stock in the wrong things, that I'm not necessarily looking at the driver's racecraft or his ability to dissect data and telemetry that is being fed to him by his team or shared by his teammate.
Yep.
But I just genuinely like him. And I think he's really interesting. And he and I have a lot of common interests. And I love his creativity when it comes to his clothing. And I love his... And all of our listeners now are just like cringing, by the way, like, what the hell is Hamilton talking about? But I feel like if I knew him in real life and he lived here in Vancouver, that we would probably be friends. And we would probably go for bubble tea, and we would probably go to the F1 simulator at Brentwood Town Center. Like, I feel like he and I would be friends. So I really like him. I'm cheering for him. And I desperately want to see a Grand Prix back in China next year, because I really want to see what that crowd would look like if they had a Chinese driver on the grid. And there's no guarantee we'll be back in China next year. It's on the calendar. That race may not happen. I hope it does, because I really want to see what type of support and what level of support a country of a billion people can give this talented young Chinese driver.
Yeah, it would be interesting, but I just like to add that I'm more than willing to be Zhou Guanyu's proxy friend for you. So, I mean, I like bubble tea. I like going to the F1 simulator, Brentwood. So, I'm just saying.
Okay,
so
just
you don't have to answer now.
No,
you don't have to answer
fair,
now.
And I'm gonna put our business in the streets. The last time I tried to arrange something with you, your availability was not in the days or weeks, but it's like I can probably fit you in Q2 of 2024. So I stopped trying to arrange things with you.
that's a good comeback. I'm just gonna leave it there, because I have a feeling if I try to like dig myself out of this hole, I'm just gonna dig myself even deeper. So
the closest thing that you and I have ever had to a social gathering is when we ran into each other at the self-checkout line at Walmart. That's as close as we've ever come to a social gathering. And at first I didn't, we were still wearing masks.
There was fist bumps. There was some contact there.
So it was funny too, because I think at that point you and I had only ever met we'd probably done 100 podcasts, but only ever met in person one time. And we were still wearing masks at the time. And you were speaking to me. I'm like,
I know,
who is
so
this
weird
guy? And it took me a couple of minutes to clue in, because I'm not used to seeing you with it, or wasn't used to seeing you with a mask. So yeah. Again, putting far too much business in the streets.
Yeah, wasn't that sort of like a weird kind of like contradiction to that like point in time? Is we were used to like seeing each other like maskless at a time where everywhere you went, everybody was like wearing a mask. I was like, I wonder what this person looks like when they don't have a mask on. Anyways, that's another discussion for another time. Okay, we'll take one quick time out, come back. Still got a couple news stories to discuss. We got to talk about the Singapore Grand Prix, which is going to kick off this weekend. You know, just, well, we're a day ahead of our usual recording schedule, but FP1 coming up in the day after tomorrow. So we'll get to all of that in just a moment, and we'll be back to discuss this and more. So don't go away. Okay, welcome back. And the next story to check out, this one you guys should really hop online, go onto Twitter, Instagram, go to your favorite F1 news site or wherever, because McLaren is going to be running a bit of a different livery in the next two races. And it's what's called Future Mode, and it looks pretty, pretty sharp. Mark, you want to tell us a little bit more about this one?
Not really. I wasn't expecting to, but I will. So I think the easiest way to describe this, and I'm a huge fan of that whole sci-fi concept of cyberpunk. Think about a Formula One livery in a cyberpunk movie like Hackers or Johnny Mnemonic. It's super cool. There's some neon. Yep. And one of the things that people astutely called out was that this livery does a really good job of helping illustrate how much development McLaren have put into their side pod design over the course of the season, because I think a lot of the mock-ups and a lot of the photos that we see of the McLaren car are earlier kind of not production photos, but earlier photo shoot shots that are distributed to the media. And this is kind of the first time that we're getting a fresh batch of photos out of the McLaren media office. So not only is the livery really cool, it's kind of got this cool techno punk, cyberpunk kind of look and feel to it with a lot of neon. But it also helps to really illustrate the development that they've done through the car in terms of its aerodynamic formula. So pretty cool. And I'm definitely excited to see it. And I believe it's going to be run for two Grand Prix. So it's going to be run this weekend in Singapore. Should look really cool under the lights, because of course it's a night race. And then we're going to see it at the Japanese Grand Prix as well. And both of this is part of a tie-up with team sponsor OKX. And if you ask me what OKX is, I do not know, but I will Google it in the background. So I'm ready next time.
All right. Well, one thing we don't need to Google is the fact that Alex Albon will be back in the car this weekend after that shocking incident he had with the complications after his appendicitis surgery a couple of weeks ago. Glad to hear that that he's feeling better. He's doing better. And not only that, he's healthy enough to actually get back in the car and go racing this weekend after he had respiratory failure a couple of weeks ago after the Italian Grand Prix. I mean, that was just a shocking thing, because I remember, well, I mean, we all knew that that he wasn't going to race and Nyck de Vries was filling in for him. But when I got up on Monday morning and I was sitting there doom scrolling first thing in the morning, like everybody does, that when I saw that, my eyes literally popped out of my head that Alex Albon had suffered a respiratory failure. What was it? Was it a bad reaction to anesthetic like that after his operation for appendicitis? It was a really, really rare and freak thing that that happened to him. And, you know, thank goodness that that he was okay, because I mean, by the time that I read it, it's just like, yeah, he's already been, you know, he's going to be home pretty quick and he's already improved quite a bit. But that was just a shocking bit of news. Okay, now this is going to be another one that's going to be kind of fun to speculate about. And this is an article that comes from the courtesy of therace.com. And this is, you know, discussing whether or not a reserve driver role would be basically, you know, a win or lose a situation for Danny Ricciardo, should that actually come to pass. So I don't know about this one, Mark. I don't know. I've sort of thought about this one and, you know, just where, you know, the arc of Ricciardo's career is gone since he parted ways with Red Bull at the end of the 2018 season. It's like I was saying before their break, just the fact that you go from Red Bull to Renault to McLaren, and now all of a sudden the only team that you're being linked to for like a race seat is Haas, is just kind of like, whoa, that's kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel. But the whole reserve driver role at Mercedes is interesting. I don't think you'd want to turn that opportunity down, perhaps. But again, it just... it seems like an odd discussion to be having involving a guy like Danny Ricciardo, but I mean, he's really fallen off a lot from where he was a couple of years ago. I mean, where he was, he really peaked when he was at Red Bull, and of course, Renault wasn't at the same level, and McLaren, obviously that's been a bit of a struggle since he's been there. But I mean, to be going talking about reserve driver rules, even with Mercedes, and then race seats with Haas, it's just, you know, even 2 months ago, I didn't think we would be sitting here having this sort of conversation about Daniel Ricciardo.
Yeah, Daniel Ricciardo, certainly one of the most charismatic, likable, personable people in F1. But it's really hard, Mark. It's really hard now after 2 years of watching him get absolutely thrashed by his teammate at McLaren to build a business case to keep him in F1. And maybe a team will. I don't think it's going to be Williams. Maybe it's going to be Haas. But if not Haas, he could be forced into... I don't even want to call it a sabbatical, because a sabbatical implies that there might be an opportunity or a path for him to return to Formula One in 2024. My fear is that if I'm Daniel Ricciardo, if I can't secure,
but also,
go on, please.
If sabbatical makes it also seem
voluntary.
Like it's voluntary.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Sorry to jump in.
That makes total sense.
Carry on,
and
please.
My fear is if I'm Daniel Ricciardo, if there's an option for me to race next year, I don't really have an option, because if I take a sabbatical, and it is a voluntary sabbatical, there's no guarantee I'm going to come back in 2024. And if I do, there's no guarantee that seat's going to be any better than what was available for me for 2023. But if there is no seat available to me, and there was a test driver, reserve driver type role, as the race.com kind of implies that, and they're not implying, by the way, they're not saying or reporting that, hey, there's an option for him to go to Mercedes as a test or a reserve driver. They're just saying that would be a really great fit for him if there wasn't a Formula One seat, because he could spend a year, like Esteban Ocon did, surrounded by an absolutely premier organization and have the opportunity to sit in for a Mercedes driver or an Aston Martin driver or a Williams driver, or like the article said, ironically, a McLaren driver, because they're all Mercedes power unit partners. That would be a good option for him. But I think that if there's going to be an option for him next year, it's probably going to be Haas. And I just don't know how that extends his career, because I just have no confidence in them improving that car. And that team seems to, and I should level set a little bit too, because we were talking during the Spaces chat earlier tonight about the fact that it felt like the championship was much tighter through the first third of the calendar. And it felt like the regulations were really working, but now it feels like the pack's really starting to separate, especially at the top end, that those teams at the bottom end are really trailing off, and those teams at the top end, especially Red Bull, are really pulling away. And it may reflect negatively on the new regulations. And Marshall made this great point, which is really astute. It's not that Red Bull's necessarily gotten better. It's just that in a cost cap era where teams only have X amount of money to spend on developing a car, a lot of teams in the championship simply tapped out. They tapped out early on in the championship and said, we're not investing in this car anymore. We're taking our remaining budget and we're driving that into the 2023 car. So it's not that Haas and Alfa Romeo and Alfa Tauri and Williams, it's not that they're not spending money that's at their disposal. It's that they're spending the money on the 2023 car. So they basically froze development of this current car. So it looks worse than it probably is. And when we kick off 2023, it should be a little closer. So I don't know where I was going with all of this, but ultimately to get back to the original point, if Ricciardo has an opportunity to sign with any team, he has to do it, because there's no guarantee there's going to be a ride available for him for 2024. And if there is no ride and there was a test driver, reserve driver type role with Mercedes, I think that would be the next best thing to having a full-time seat next season.
Yeah, 100%. But still, I find this very, very strange territory to be in when talking about Danny Ricciardo. But I know where you were trying to go with all this. You were actually just trying to get through this as quickly as possible, because you've got a couple of stories picked out here for MotoGP Corner, which you neglected literally for months, and now it's become a thing again. You know, which is cool. I mean, I'm cool with it. Everybody that's listening is cool with it. So, you know, let's do this. Let's do MotoGP Corner.
And I know you're not as hot on the IndyCar bandwagon as I am, but the IndyCar, the 2023 NTT IndyCar Series schedule has been posted. It will be beginning on March 5th in St. Petersburg, on the streets of St. Petersburg. It'll be broadcast on NBC Peacock, and the championship will conclude on September 10th at Laguna Seca, one of my favorite racetracks in all of North America, and it is an 18-race championship. But bouncing over to MotoGP Corner, Marc Marquez is back, baby. He's back. So after the Japanese Grand Prix, his first MotoGP race where he said, I quote unquote, didn't feel any pain, he performed exceptionally. So of course, he was back 2 weeks ago. He made his big return to MotoGP after his major surgery earlier this year. He returned in Aragon in Spain. Wasn't a great performance, but it's kind of getting a sense of the bike, kind of rebuilding his confidence. But in the Japanese Grand Prix, he qualified on pole, his first pole position in 1,071 days. It was a wet session. It was an absolutely electric qualifying run. He killed it. Now, he didn't score a podium for the race. He did finish in the top four, which is fantastic. But Marc Marquez is back, baby, and I couldn't be happier. And the other news story from MotoGP world is that we are going to Kazakhstan for 2023. So like F1, the MotoGP calendar. And so in MotoGP, there's a Liberty equivalent. It's called Dorna, the sport. The commercial rights owner for the sport is called a company called Dorna. But they've been expanding the calendar in MotoGP, just like Formula One has been expanding their calendar globally. And it was announced earlier this week that we are going to a brand new track in Kazakhstan for 2023. And I'm usually excited about new tracks and new races, but I'm not particularly excited about going to Kazakhstan, particularly because of the country's close and very warm relationship with Russia. Also announced, though, earlier this week or in the month of September, is it looks like MotoGP is going to go to India. Probably won't be for 2023, but we'll probably have a run of races from 2024 to 2031 in India at the same track that used to previously host a Moto or a Formula One race, which I think was 2011, 12, 13. And then finally, it was also announced that it looks like MotoGP is going to finalize an agreement to start racing in, I don't know where I was going with that. Oh, yes. MotoGP has also finalized an agreement, or is in the process of finalizing an agreement, to start racing in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So lots of MotoGP news.
Cool. Interesting.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
You know, it was fun. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not quite done yet, because I was just going to say, looking at these these mock-ups, these pictures of the new track in Kazakhstan, I'm not sure what kind of vibe I'm getting from this. I don't know if it reminds me of Sakhir, if it reminds me of LaSalle in Qatar. I think maybe it reminds me a little bit of the track layout in Qatar. I don't, but I'll have to do some comparing afterwards to see which one it is, because it looks kind of familiar, but it looks like a very, you know, well-suited track for MotoGP. Anyways, it's that time. Let's talk about the race coming up this weekend. It is the Singapore Grand Prix, the first time that we're going to be in Singapore since 2019. Obviously, washed out the last couple of years because of the pandemic. So the last time that we were in, I was going to say Qatar, you know, just completely randomly getting off track there. But the last time we were in Singapore, more accurately, Charles Leclerc was on pole. His pole time was 136.217. We had a podium of Sebastian Vettel, Charles Leclerc for Ferrari 1-2, and then some guy by the name of Max Verstappen, might have heard of him, finished third that day. And so the most wins that we've seen there has been five by Sebastian Vettel. Ferrari, Mercedes are equal on wins there for constructors. They both have four each. It's a fairly long track for a street circuit. It's 5.1 kilometers, or just under 3.15 miles. Race length is 308.7 kilometers, or 191.8 miles, 61 laps. And, you know, with a pole time of 136, I mean, it's quite a long lap, especially for a street circuit. I mean, there aren't really too many spots where these drivers can kind of ease off and relax. It's fairly technical. It's got a couple of faster sections, but it's definitely not as tight and technical, like, and as short and compact as Monaco, but it's not as wide open and flat out as we see in Azerbaijan at Baku City. But it's an interesting race. I mean, when you look at it, the fastest lap was set by Kevin Magnussen. His fastest lap is a 142.3. So, I mean, it's a pretty long lap. And like I say, I've missed this race. I mean, it takes a fair amount of time to get through this. It's a bit of a grind to watch, but under the lights in Singapore, beautiful venue, beautiful track, really looking forward to it. I mean, there, you know, you've picked out this nice article from planetf1.com, which kind of lists out the top 10 moments from the Singapore Grand Prix that we've seen over the years. We've seen Lewis's what they call perfect lap that he set taking pole in 2018. You can check that out on Planet F1 at Planet_F1. They've got a video of that on Twitter. Sebastian Vettel's last win, probably going to be his last win in Formula One. I mean, after this weekend, we've got, what, 5 races left? So unless something bizarre moves or something happens for Sebastian Vettel, doubt he's going to win another Formula One race. Fernando Alonso giving Mark Webber a lift on the side of his Ferrari. Heikki Kovalainen having a big fire in his Lotus in 2010. But the one that everyone will talk about and remember is Crashgate from way back in 2008 involving Nelson Piquet Jr. And Mark, why don't you walk us through Crashgate? It is one of those benchmark, very controversial moments in Formula One that people that have been following the sport for a while, it's one of those things you just can't forget,
One of the absolute most shameful moments in the modern history of F1. I think you and I have talked so much about Spygate, especially because it was so interwoven with the first book club episode that we did with friend of the show, Bert Pinkerton, a couple of months ago. Spygate, of course, was kind of that moment of espionage and data sharing and information sharing between McLaren and Ferrari. But in 2008 at the Singapore Grand Prix, Renault F1 effectively requested that driver Nelson Piquet Jr. deliberately crash his car in an effort to help aid Fernando Alonso with the win of the race. And I'm going to quote here from Wikipedia because they do a good job of summarizing this, but quote unquote, in September 2009, Renault F1 admitted to an FIA World Motorsport Council meeting that Piquet had deliberately crashed per instructions from Renault team principal Flavio Briatore and chief engineer Pat Simmons in the hope of helping Alonso win. The Renault team were handed a disqualification from F1, basically a ban, which was suspended for 2 years pending any further rule infringements. Briatore was banned from all FIA sanctioned events for life, while Simmons was banned for 5 years. Briatore and Simmons sued the FIA in French courts on January 5th, 2010. The Tribunal de Grande Instance overturned the ban, which had been put in place on both men. So an absolutely shameful, shocking moment. And in a way, it stained the early years of the Singapore Grand Prix, because the Singapore Grand Prix kind of came together pretty quickly. It was announced in 2007. It was a quick relationship between, of course, Bernie Eccleston and the race organizers. It came together quickly. Of course, there were races there as far back as the 60s, but it was kind of the renewal of the Singapore Grand Prix. It was announced in 2007. It happened in 2008. It was the first night race in F1, and it got a lot of media attention because of that. Of course, next year, we're going to have 6 night races. But ultimately, the initial race and the initial years were stained by this. Now, of course, when the crash happened in 2008, it just seemed like a really funny coincidence. You know, ultimately Alonso won the race and he went up and he celebrated. I think Nico finished second that race, and I think Lewis may have finished third. But ultimately, it wasn't really until months and a year later where the information started to leak out about what had actually happened. And just imagine now in the current moment of F1, if a team asked one of their drivers on the radio, covertly told that driver, you need to crash your car. And if I recall exactly, it looked like coming out of a corner, he oversteered and lost the back end and the car slammed into a wall. But it's just absurd to think that somebody would ask a driver to risk their personal well-being, not to mention the cost of a Formula One car, to aid their other driver with a potential win. And of course, in 2008, it's not like Renault was a particularly competitive team and they weren't chasing a championship, but it was just a shocking moment in a series of shocking moments in F1 over the back part of that decade.
And as a former sports writer for the Times newspaper, Simon Barnes wrote, quote, as a single act, a single deliberate act of breaking the laws of sport, this probably counts as the worst case of cheating in sporting history, end quote. And if that's the case, then Shoeless Joe Jackson and the other members of the 1919 White Sox are saying it's about time people stop talking about us. But, you know, joking aside, I mean, that was pretty shocking that that they concocted this malarkey to pull this, you know,
it's
to
why
do this,
earlier this
you know?
Year when there was there was reports that Briatore might be coming back to F1. It's why you and I got so worked up, because there can be no world in which he can re-enter Formula One in any capacity. Like, he cannot be associated with Formula One. Like, what he did and the instructions that he provided a driver is absolutely obscene and unforgivable, and he can never come back to F1 in any capacity whatsoever.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, to me, after that was exposed, I mean, he had no more credibility or no more place in Formula One. I mean, if you get caught cheating like that, I mean, you're done. You know, please don't come back. Looking ahead to the race itself, you found a pretty cool graphic here from at F1 Data Geek, and this is the points scored by team in the history of the race, well, since 2008. So since all of those races have been run over the past, 15 years or so, Red Bull have scored almost a quarter of the available points at with 293, followed by Mercedes with 244, Ferrari 235. So that's 24.2% respectively for Red Bull, 20.1% for Mercedes, and 19.4% for Ferrari. And then from there, it's kind of interesting. McLaren, surprisingly, fourth most points. That's they've scored 140 points there. Alpine/Renault 91, Williams 57, Aston Martin, I guess, /Racing Point 56, AlphaTauri/Toro Rosso 44, 30 points for Toyota. So, I mean, they still factor in there somewhere. 12 for BMW, 8 for Alfa Romeo, and 2 for Haas, which represents a very wimpy 0.2% of the total points available since 2008 on the streets of Singapore. So this weekend at the race, Pirelli are bringing the softest tires, compounds in their range, to the race, the C3 hards, C4 mediums, and the C5 softs. We've kind of been over some of the stats in terms of length and race distance. But again, I mean, do we want to go and predict somebody else than a Red Bull winning this race? It's just, I know it's been kind of predictable, and it's a little bit kind of weak for us not to pick anyone else. But I mean, since the Austrian Grand Prix back at the beginning of July, that's half a dozen races. Max has won 5 out of 6. He finished second in Austria. His worst finish to date was at the British Grand Prix, and that was 7th, and that's when he had that damaged floor. I mean, other than that, I mean, this guy hasn't finished worse than 3rd. I mean, of course, if you want to talk about the DNF way back at round 1 in Bahrain, that's here way back in the middle of March. So Max was still qualified at classified in 19th, but wow, I just can't bet against or even advise against, not picking Max, especially after, you know, his recent run of form. I mean, he's just in form. The car's been on the rails. I mean, it's just the whole package has been there for car, engine, driver, tires. And I'm just not willing to go away from that this weekend. I'd love to see somebody else do something. I just, until proven otherwise, I just don't see anybody knocking Max off right now. But again, this is a street circuit. Anything can and often does happen on these types of tracks. So I sit back and hope to be proven wrong come Sunday afternoon or evening. I guess Saturday evening here. Absolutely. On the West Coast.
And I very much agree with you that if I was a betting man and I was going to put money on anybody at this point, it would be absolutely Max Verstappen and Red Bull. There's no reason not to, but you make a great point that this is a very, very tight, very technical, and very physically demanding track for drivers, and mistakes happen. And it can only take, you know what, that back end breaking out or slipping out on you when you hit the wall and you break a suspension and the safety car comes out. And we've obviously seen Max in the past as well make mistakes on street courses, and anything is possible. And you mentioned last week when you were going through one of those really cool visuals, which maybe isn't so great on the podcast, but you were kind of describing the fact that this is a race that has seen a safety car in every iteration, and we should absolutely expect to see a safety car here. So it could be one of those races where Max potentially qualifies qualifies on pole, or maybe he doesn't, but he takes an early lead and he starts building on that lead lap over lap over lap. But if there's a safety car, that field could potentially get bunched up again. We could have a safety car restart. We could have a red flag. A lot of things could happen. So if you haven't seen a Singapore Grand Prix before, which is probably a big chunk of our audience because we haven't been there since 2019, I totally advise you to check in. It's a really cool experience. The backdrop is
cool
experience.
Yep.
But like you said, it's a grind sometimes to watch, but it can also be a bit of a grind to drive for the drivers as well. And because of that, there's often the possibility of a driver making a mistake at some point somewhere in the field. So I'm excited for this race. I want to see how it plays out. There's an outside possibility that Max could win the driver's title this race weekend. I think it's probably more likely that he's going to do it in Japan. And if not in Japan, then absolutely, with all certainty, he's going to win it in Austin. But of course, a lot of reasons to tune in. And regardless of whether you're a Max fan or not, if you're committed to the championship, I think it's just, you're a good sport if you tune in to see somebody win a championship, because you don't win championships necessarily by accident. A lot of work and energy and talent goes into winning a championship. So yeah, I'm excited for this race weekend. I just know it's going to be a drive for these grind for these drivers, and hopefully it's not a grind for us to watch at home.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, just as I was thinking about what you were talking here, when it comes to Charles Leclerc, I mean, obviously he still has a mathematical shout of winning this world championship. I mean, in reality, it's just not going to happen. And I mean, all these guys are pros, so I mean, they're always going to go out there and drive their hardest. But what is Charles's motivation at this point in the season? Is this just to try and maybe change the narrative a little bit? Because I mean, he's obviously had some challenges. He retired in France. He had a P6 in Hungary, a P6 in Belgium, but in Holland and then in Italy, he had two podium finishes, a third and a second, respectively. So what is he aiming for now? Is it to try and change the narrative a little bit that, or are we already there that he should have been challenging Max a lot closer and running a lot, running this championship further down to the wire than it was? I mean, it's basically been Max's wrapped up a long, long time ago. So I just kind of wonder, I mean, what is his motivation now? I mean, obviously you're looking towards wiping the slate clean and starting over next year, but you know, you want to finish with some positive feeling from this year. So maybe that's what it is that he just wants to finish on the strongest, best note that he can and try and salvage something from a season that really got away from them. Because I don't think, based on what we saw, that it's too much of a stretch from the beginning of the season before things really went pear-shaped for Ferrari, that they should have really been more of a contender in these championships, both for the drivers' championship and for the constructors as well. So, who knows?
What does pear shaped mean?
It's a try to.
I by the way,
it's gone
okay,
sideways.
Gotcha. Yeah. Again, I learned gone so sideways. Much. I learned so much of just by doing this podcast with you.
Yeah, so now we'll probably get another message that pear shape means something different, because you know, inadvertently I picked up on another cricket term that I didn't know about, but you know, that was kind of funny. I haven't used that duck saying again, because I'm still not entirely clear on what is the proper context to use it in. But I don't know, Hammy, you got anything else to add for this one? You know, like I say, I mean, unless something happens, I don't really. I'm not willing to walk away from my prediction. I mean, the podium, I guess, is kind of up for grabs, but who knows? You know, is Mercedes a bit of a dark horse, or does it really come down to attrition? Because, you know, it's going to be hot. It's going to be humid. It's going to be very demanding on both car and driver. And like you say, that we've seen a safety car here every single time we've raced here since 2008. So lots can and probably
I wanted to quickly read out a DM that I got from, or we got from, one of our listeners today, Jamie Loy from Australia. Hi, Mark and Mark. Currently at the airport waiting for my flight to Singapore. Very excited for my first GP.
Oh, jealous.
Spent the drive down to Melbourne catching up on the last couple of pod episodes. Just wanted to say thank you for all the great work that you guys do. Love that I can tune in and find out what's happening in the F1 world. I found lately I'm not watching as many races live due to the ridiculous times here in Australia, but your show definitely keeps the interest alive. I found lately I'm not watching as many races of the races live due to the ridiculous times in Australia, but your show definitely keeps the interest alive. Hoping for a good competitive race in Singapore. Also, break your duck comes from cricket. If you get out for zero runs, it's called a duck. So once you've scored, you've broken your duck. So once again, Jamie, thank you so much. I hope you have a fantastic time at the Singapore Grand Prix. You've got both of us quite jealous.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, did you know that last week I checked out the AFL Grand Final? It was on TSN, and one of my colleagues at work is from Perth, Australia. So you know, he texted me. He's like, "Hey, if you're looking for something cool to watch this evening, go check out the AFL Final." I don't really know a lot about Aussie rules, but I love the spectacle of any big event like that. So I sat down, watched it, and the one thing that just blows me away about Australian rules football is just the size of the fields. And we were talking about it at work. Yep. That some of these players, like over the course of an entire match, they run like 14, 15, 16 kilometers. I mean, you look at these guys, it is a hard, hard physical sport. And, you know, you got to be tough to play it, but you also have to be extremely fit. And, you know, I haven't watched a lot of Aussie rules football in my lifetime, but I've watched a little bit, and I'm just constantly impressed by the standard, the quality, the level that you have to be just as an athlete to play this sport at any, you know, competitive level. Is it's just something else.
How did we get onto Australian rules football, my friend? I did want to actually segue to the NBA. The NBA. So just this comment from Jamie Lloyd, because I this comment actually resonated for me. So he said this, I found lately I'm not watching as many of the races live due to the ridiculous times in Australia, but your show definitely keeps the interest alive, hoping for a good competitive race in Singapore. I actually do the same thing with the NBA. So I am a huge NBA fan, but over the years, I found myself watching less and less games, but consuming more and more NBA podcasts. So a lot of the NBA content that I absorb now is through podcasts, not even watching the races. So I think for a lot of people, we are their outlet, that not everyone can be on planetf1.com and autosport.com and therace.com every day absorbing the news. I think a lot of people come to us because, hey, you know what, rather than like throughout the course of the week jumping on social media and jumping on these news sites, I know I can tune in once a week and Mark and Mark are going to summarize all the stories for me, so I don't have to. And if I miss a race, that's not such a bad thing, because I know on Sunday night, Monday morning, Mark and Tim are going to get together and they're going to rehash that race, and they're going to touch on all the main storylines that maybe I would have missed that race weekend. So again, it's okay if you don't watch every single race. I consider myself a diehard NBA fan. I don't watch every single Raptors game, for instance.
Yeah. You know, just to sort of close this one out, did you see that story this week? Kyrie was saying that he reckons he not getting vaxxed cost him something like $100 million. And I'm just like, holy
shit. I have some strong opinions on Kyrie Irving.
Yeah, that was like in all the different things I've been consuming this week, that story about Kyrie really jumped out at me, because $100 million is it's a lot of money, even for you and me, surprisingly.
It's about what we spent on our studio, right? Like that was about maybe a little less, like $97-98 million we spent on the studios.
Yeah, the Scuderi F1 worldwide headquarters, which is my basement and your basement connected by the wonders of the internet. And on that note, guys, thank you very much for checking out the show this week. Thank you for the DMs. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for all you guys, Rolando, Rocky, Reiko, the Flagstaff, Daniel, everybody that was on the live stream and the chat. Love it. If I missed anybody, my apologies, but love to see you guys that can join us when we do this live. And of course, all of you that listen to us on demand and download the podcast. And if you want to do anything to support us, all we ask is you spend a couple moments of your time. Doesn't cost any money. Go to Spotify, go to Apple Podcasts, or wherever you download, enjoy all podcasts, and leave us a nice rating and review. And that really helps us out a lot more than you realize. So on that note, and on behalf of Mr. Mark Hamilton, thank you for hanging out. Have a great night. Have a great rest of the week. Enjoy Singapore Grand Prix. We'll be back with Tim Haraney on Sunday sometime, depending on the bizarre time difference, to try and sort this out, not only across the country here, but also taking in the massive time difference between North America and the Far East in Singapore. We'll make it work somehow. We'll do it. And so look forward to drop on Sunday night into your feeds. And until then, have a great Formula One weekend, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye for now.